طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts. Today we finish our coverage of the November 12th, 2019 Criminalizing Dissent Conference held at UMass Amherst. This was an enormously important conference held despite the fact that the Zionist lobby as well as university officials tried to stop it from even happening. They were not successful. And with the help of a court order, the conference proceeded. The auditorium was packed, as was a similar conference held in the spring of 2019. And as you will hear, this one also was challenged by audience hecklers who were expertly handled by the panelists. This is an important moment in the conference, and we have not edited it out. This morning, you will first hear the presentation of organizer Sean King, and then the closing panel discussion with all the participants whose speeches were presented on This Week in Palestine and our two preceding broadcasts. The panel consisted of Linda Sarsour, Tim Wise, Cornell West, Dimi Khalidi, and Sean King. Here we go with part three of the Conference on Criminalizing Dissent held at UMass Amherst.
Next up, I want to bring up a dear brother, an activist, an organizer, a writer, someone who, if you ever hear about an injustice and you trace it back, you probably heard about it from him, using his platform to elevate some of the most horrific acts of injustice, particularly from law enforcement on black communities across America and our black sisters and brothers. He also wrote a book. He's probably not going to do this, but I will. He wrote a book called Making Change that's going to be coming out next year after my book, so make sure you get it. Making Change by Sean King. So I want you, UMass, to welcome our dear brother to the stage, activist, organizer, and writer Sean King.
Hello. So good to see each and every one of you here. I'm glad to be here. Linda and I drove up together from Brooklyn, and now I'm just hoping that it doesn't snow so we can still get home to Brooklyn later tonight. I'm honored to be here. I'm honored to be able to support the BDS movement. And in so many ways, boycotts come out of the black struggle for civil rights, at least for me. And I want to share a story, really my origin story as an organizer, even share some points of some mistakes that I've made as an organizer, but then share the lessons that I've learned, because I'm hoping that my contribution here tonight is for you to be able to help us organize this movement in deep ways. About 5 years ago, I was not organizing for social justice. I had been an organizer when I was an undergrad in college. I went to Morehouse College in Atlanta. I was student government president there in 1999 when the NYPD shot and killed a young brother named Amadou Diallo 41 times on the doorstep of his home. We didn't have Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. There was no YouTube. And so it was almost 10 days after Amadou had been shot and killed before the news even got to us on campus. And we organized protests and demonstrations. 7 years later, there was a young man, again in New York, named Sean Bell, who was shot 50 times just hours before he was to be married on his wedding day. We organized and protested for Sean Bell. But 7 years after that, in 2014, I was actually working at an environmental charity called Global Green, and my family and I had moved from Atlanta to Southern California, and I was the director of communications for that charity. And many of my friends from Morehouse who knew me really as Sean the activist, as Sean who organized against mass incarceration and police brutality, sent me a YouTube video. And at that time, it had not gone viral. We didn't know the man's name in the video. But he sent me a YouTube video via a Facebook message. And he said, Sean, there's a video that he had found. He lived in New York. He said, Sean, there's this video that I found on YouTube. It's of a middle-aged black man who is asking the police to stop harassing him. And he said, Sean, all of a sudden, a police officer comes up behind the man and begins choking him and wrestles him to the ground and continues to choke him. I hadn't clicked on the video yet. This is my friend's description. He says, Sean, you can hear the man yelling out, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. He says, Sean, the guy dies right there on the sidewalk. And you have to go back in time 5 years, because in July of 2014, when I got that message, there had never been a viral video of police brutality. Many of us in this room have now seen dozens of such videos, but at that time, no such video had ever been shared. And I clicked on the link and I saw the man that we later came to know as Eric Garner. And it was the first time in my life that I had ever seen, not in the movies, but in real life, seen a man who was fully alive at the beginning of that video and yet be fully dead by the end of it. He died right there on that sidewalk. And I watched as officers, the whole video is about 11 minutes long, and people cut it up into 15-second clips. If you've never seen the whole video, officers began poking at him like he was an animal and even thought that he was pretending as if he was asleep. They had killed him. It was literally my last day working at Global Green. That day was the day that I started trying to figure out how I could organize just my friends, just my family, my network, to try to get justice for this man. 3 weeks later, I got a text message about a teenage boy named Mike Brown who was shot and killed on a street in a town called Ferguson outside of St. Louis. And I had the thought in my mind, wow, police are out here killing people every 2 to 3 weeks. The next day, we learned that a young man named John Crawford was shot and killed at a Walmart in Ohio. The day after that, we learned about a young man named Ezell Ford who was shot and killed by police in Los Angeles, all of them unarmed, nonviolent. And suddenly, we came to understand that police in this country weren't killing people every 2 to 3 weeks. It wasn't even every 2 to 3 days. The Washington Post and The Guardian built award-winning databases where we finally came to understand that American police were killing people 3 to 4 times a day. Every single day, like clockwork, sometimes as many as 10 or 11 times a day. We began organizing all over the country, in New York, in Los Angeles, in Ohio. And then that November, a 12-year-old boy named Tamir Rice was shot and killed by police in Cleveland, Ohio. I told Linda this story on the way here, and I said something to many of these families that I have since come to regret. I would sit down in living rooms and at kitchen tables with families who had experienced this police violence, having lost their most precious loved one there, their sons, their husbands, their fathers, their brothers, their sisters, their mothers. And to many of these families, closer even than we are right now, I looked many of these families in the face and said, hold on, hang in there, we're going to get justice for your family. And not a single part of me thought I was over-promising or under-delivering. I thought we would get justice for those families. And as we organized and marched and demonstrated, as we created hashtags and trending topics, marches and protests and die-ins and sit-ins, not a single one of those families, not one. In fact, nearly 1,200 people were shot and killed by police in 2014. And not a single family, 0.00%, got justice. None of them. Undeterred, I continue to tell families that same story. Hold on. Hang in there. We're going to get justice for your family. I told that to the family of Philando Castile as I watched him shot and killed by police on Facebook Live. And somehow I had convinced myself that his case would be the case, where certainly his family would get justice, but he didn't. I spoke that to the family of Alton Sterling, who was shot and killed in Baton Rouge. I said that to the family of a man named Terrence Crutcher, who was shot and killed in Oklahoma. Until finally I realized that the people in power who had the authority to actually bring these families some semblance of justice, I came to understand that they truly, earnestly did not care what we said. They were not moved by our protests. They were not moved by our marches or demonstrations. It's not that we were wrong to march or demonstrate or protest. Of course we were right to do so. But I came to understand that they were not moved by our hashtags or trending topics or viral videos. They were not moved by the headlines. And so we formed an organization that would ultimately replace the people who made those decisions. Understanding that if we did not organize smarter, that we did not have the type of currency with the people that we needed to be able to move. And so I learned hitting the wall over and over and over again, organizing with protesters and demonstrators all over the country. I traveled to 45 states around the country, meeting and gathering with protesters state by state, city by city, county by county. And I learned four things that we need to do to make change. As I think about us fighting back against injustice around the world, fighting back against civil rights and human rights violations, there are four things that we have to do to make change. I want to share those four things and I'll take a seat. And I hope you can duplicate them in your own way. The first thing that you need to make change is deceptive, because we often have it, and it convinces you that you're closer to change than you really are. This room has it right now. The first thing that you need to make change is you need people, and they need to be highly energized. And there's something about getting highly energized people in a room that can convince you that you are much closer to change than you really are. But having highly energized people, it's essential, but it's just the first step. And there are times where I have been in marches and protests and planning meetings and rooms like this and rallies where the energy of the people, it can cause you to think that change is a lot nearer, a lot closer than it really is. That's because you have to have the second thing. You need people and they need to be highly energized, but you need people and they need to be deeply organized. And what I think many of us have made a mistake is that we have overestimated the value of being right and being good at the expense of also organizing ourselves. Let me push that a little bit. Have integrity, be right, be on the right side of the issue. But I need us to understand that you can be right and lose over and over and over again. And what it does is it causes many of us who believe strongly that we are on the right side of this issue, often it causes us to think that we're destined to lose, that we will always lose. But I need us to understand that being right is not enough. It's never enough. Being energized is not enough. Here is evidence of this. In 2018, in the midterm elections, both Beto and Stacey Abrams and Andrew Gillum were each mentioned 300% more than their opponents on Twitter and lost. They had the people, and the people were highly energized, but tweets are not votes. Angry face emojis are not votes. your best intentioned Instagram post is not a vote. And I'm not saying don't click the angry face emoji, don't retweet it, don't write a well-intentioned post, but it's not a vote. We are often highly energized, but hardly organized. Right? Now, for many people, the answer is to lower our energy. I'm not saying that. I'm saying to up the quality of our organization. Here are two examples of how this group could organize, and I hope you duplicate it. And as I've started to do this, and as the teams that I'm a part of have started to do this, we have found our work to be way more effective. Here are two ways that you could organize deeply. The first is, ask yourself, who are the people that you know that could help you on this issue? Let me give you an illustration. I was organizing around a very particular law that we were trying to pass in New York, and the team that I was a part of needed to find somebody who was in a personal relationship with a particular politician. We needed a son or a daughter. We needed somebody that was close to this politician that we could meet with, that could give us a personal introduction to this person. And we searched and searched and could not find it. 2 weeks after the deadline passed and we failed to pass this law, we learned that that politician's godson was on our email list. He just didn't know we were looking for him. Sometimes you have to ask the people in the room, in your group, on your list, who are the 5 people, who are the 10 people that you know that could help us in this? That is to say, build your network deeper. And sometimes there are people in the room who have the relationship that you need, they just didn't know that you needed it. Here's another deeper form of organization. Find the skills of the people in the room. To me, the most underused asset in all of our movements for change are the human resources and skills of the people. But what I find is, as we collect email addresses and phone numbers for people, we often don't actually ask them, what are you good at? What skill do you have? What passion do you have that you could use? I'm a part of a team now that only has about 2 staff members, but we have about 200 highly skilled part-time and full-time volunteers that make our work so much more effective just because we took the time to find the skills in the room. You need energized people. You need organized people. And here's what I see happening across the country, and Linda's right. There's a lot of good news to share about the growth of this movement. Here's what I see happening. You need energized people and organized people. You need sophisticated plans that are as complex as the problem you're trying to solve. What I often find is when you are energized and organized, all of a sudden you begin moving in the right direction. But I have often seen energized, organized people confront a highly complex problem with a plan that you could write on the back of a napkin, and the size and force of that problem overwhelms the simplicity of their plan. I started asking activists and organizers around the country, not in a pandering or condescending way, I started asking them to share with me their plan. And I talk about this in my book. And I started noticing a trend right away as I asked organizers, show me your plan. I want to earnestly see it and understand it. What organizers would often do is repeat to me in beautiful, meticulous, expert-level detail the problem. And they had very subtly confused an expert-level understanding of the problem, which is great and necessary, with the plan. And often, because we are close to the pain, and many of you in the room feel this problem, it is your problem. When you are close to the problem, you think about it, you consider it. Your people are experiencing it. But understanding the problem is not the plan. And often we go to battle, energized and organized, with plans that will never be able to confront the problem we're up against. And I need every one of us in the room to check ourselves and ask ourselves, is our plan as sophisticated as the problem we're trying to solve? And as we begin to build out the quality of our plans with energized and organized people, we will begin to see movement. And then I'll say the last thing unapologetically, and it's part of my role as an organizer. If you are energized, organized, and have sophisticated plans, you will see some change. But if you do not fund them, if you do not provide them with the resources that are necessary, they will not be able to grow to scale. Now, raise your hand if you're a college student in the room. So I'm sure if you opened up the bank app on your phone, there's not a whole lot of resources in there to share. But if we're not each, hear me, chipping in a little bit, if you're not budgeting change, if social change is not a part of your weekly and monthly budget, hear me. I need you to understand that there are organizations, there's a conservative organization in this country that is energized, organized, with sophisticated plans, that is very well funded. It's called the NRA. Last year was their worst year financially in 10 years. Well, hold on. And they raised $330 million on a down year. And here's what I understand. They are not an organization for change. They're an organization that blocks change. And there are many organizations right now that are aiming to block the change of the people in this room. They don't have the energy we have. They may not even have the organization we have, but their plans are often more complex, and here's where they often win. They often outfund our work, sometimes 10 to 1, 20 to 1. And I need us to understand that as we invest our energy and resources into organizing the movement to boycott, to divest, to force sanctions upon people who have human rights violations, it will amplify their effectiveness. Do you understand what I'm saying? You need to be energized, organized, with sophisticated plans, and we have to find ways to fund them. Thank you so much.
Give it up one more time for Sean King.
You have been listening to the final presentation by Sean King. And now we move to the panel discussion involving all the participants, moderated by Linda Sarsour.
Opportunity to just join this conversation on this panel. I wanted to ask him to just quickly share with us what the current iteration of the BDS movement is, where are people needed in this particular moment for those who want to be a part of it or support in this moment. So if there's a particular campaign that the BDS movement is kind of focusing on right now or areas where you think people can jump in, Omar, we would love to hear what it is.
Thanks, Linda, and thanks for the wonderful panel. I'm really honored to be with you, although in cyberspace. I think there's several campaigns that one can point to. At the policy level, the most important is cutting U.S. military aid to Israel. Now that we have Bernie Sanders and many presidential candidates in the Democratic Party calling for leveraging aid to Israel, conditioning it on respect for Palestinian rights, I think we have passed a very important threshold, and we should push further. But as I said in my talk, it has to be part of an overall change of direction in the U.S. from ongoing very aggressive bullying, imperialism, hegemony around the world, neoliberalism, and 1% policies to investment in health, education, and social services, climate protection, and so on. As part of that, it's important to cut military aid to Israel because it's using it to abuse us. Our oppression has made in the USA written all over it. A second very important campaign at a more grassroots, municipal level, city council level, is a campaign led by Jewish Voice for Peace with Black justice movements and others called Deadly Exchange. It's ending the joint training of Israeli and U.S. police because they're feeding each other's racism and violence and militarism. And we see the results in Baltimore and Ferguson and Gaza and everywhere else. So that's a very important campaign. Finally, churches and some unions and some student governments are calling for divestment from specific companies involved, deeply complicit in Israel's violations of Palestinian rights, be it Caterpillar, HP, Motorola Solutions, and others. Those are very important to continue because we think that companies are listening. Some of them are already selling their business in Israel, especially their illegal business, and pulling out. So we're making it. Just to give one example, and I'll end with that, we had a seven-year campaign against Veolia, a French giant corporation. Palestinians are very patient. Yes, it took 7 years. But we had many, many supporters around the world. And after those 7 years, Veolia lost more than $20 billion with a B, billion dollars worth of contracts and tenders. And finally, they pulled out completely from Israel. So we can do it.
I just want to be on the record, Omar, to let you know how very proud I am to be of the same lineage as you, as a Palestinian, and to for all your courage and for all the work that you have done. And I want to say again on the record that I am ashamed as an American that someone of your brilliant stature is not welcome in the United States of America. But we promise you that we will continue on this path, and there will be a day where I was talking to Sean, we're going to organize a big rally at an airport to welcome you back here to share the brilliance that you've done. So we appreciate you
very much. Thank you.
So one question that I wanted to ask everybody on the stage, and it's actually a question that a lot of people ask me, and I never really know how to answer the question. There's a lot of people who will say, I agree with everything that everybody's saying. That's something that I really believe. I believe in my heart, you're logical, you make sense, and I believe this. But where do you get the courage to say these things and to stand in the convictions that you have? What was that moment for you, particularly on the issue of Palestine, where you just said one day, look, I'm going out here and just going to see what happens. Like, what was that? What was the thing or that moment for you?
Weigh in on that. I wish this wasn't the case for me, but it is. It's just my story. It's as I began developing meaningful friendships with Palestinian people, both here in the United States and around the world, it educated me, it tied me in an emotional way to the pain and oppression that was experienced there. And I think some of what happens is that we often operate in such bubbles and isolation. And I've told this story many times. For I would say the first 30 years of my life, my world was very black and white. I grew up in rural Kentucky. Then I went to college at Morehouse College, which was an all-black school for young men. Then I lived for the next 10 years in Atlanta in a community that talked very little about civil rights and human rights outside of Atlanta. And it wasn't until I started developing just deep, meaningful relationships with indigenous people that I started being educated about the problems experienced by indigenous people in this country. When I started developing, deep, Like, I see you as one of the most important people in my life. I see several of my best friends are from Palestine. And in those relationships, it just builds a natural love for people, their joy and their pain. And it's part of why I try to encourage people the best they can to get outside of your racial bubble, your generational bubble, your ethnic or religious bubble. And in doing that, the people outside of my bubble have done way more for me. I have been enriched and grown as a result way more than I've been able to reciprocate that. And so, you know, I wish that it didn't take me being in those relationships to understand, but it's what did it for me.
So for me, I told you earlier, even in Hebrew school, I had these questions that my rabbi refused to indulge. And I was sort of, you know, always questioning this idea that a Jewish kid from Nashville or a Jewish kid in Des Moines or a Jewish kid in Seattle somehow had this birthright to a land that my people hadn't been on for thousands of years, potentially, if at all, as opposed to those who had been there unbroken over a period of generations. It seemed preposterous to me. And so I always had these sort of questions that, again, we couldn't really engage. Now, having said that, though, because we who were Jewish are taught not to publicly say these things, a lot of this remained private for me. I became an activist in college, but really wasn't talking about this issue. And I was, you know, I came of age in the 80s and like a lot of people, was involved in the anti-apartheid movement vis-a-vis South Africa. And the moment that clicked for me that I knew I had to say something more publicly about this was being in that movement. And one day, I went to Tulane in New Orleans, and one day, oh, thank you. Yeah. Awesome.
There's always that one guy.
Was it New Orleans or Tulane? I think it was probably New Orleans that got the hooray there. So one day we were camped out, and we had built shanties, which was the thing we did in those days, in front of the administration building to sort of replicate the housing conditions that black South Africans were forced to live in under white minority rule. And we were in the middle of a hunger strike, like third day of the hunger strike. And I remember the rabbi at Hillel, who fashioned himself very progressive on all things except this, shocking, I know, came to me and he took me aside and he said, "I just want to thank you." And I was like, "Well, what for?" He had always been supportive of the divestment movement, to his credit, you know, and vis-a-vis South Africa, I should specify. And he said, "I want to thank you." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, because I just really appreciate how during all of this movement, we've been at it for a couple of years and trying to get Tulane to divest from companies that were propping up white minority rule." He said, "In all this time, you haven't really, you know, gotten into all of that mess about Israel's support for South Africa." And I was like, "Well, Rabbi, it's just sort of not pertinent to this particular iteration of the movement. We're talking about Tulane. It's not that I hadn't noticed, and it's not that I'm okay with it." And he's like, "Well, I just really appreciate that you haven't brought it up, because, you know, that just muddies the waters and da-da-da-da-da." And I remember going home for winter break and reading something.
"I guarantee you remember watching the movie because I disagree with Tim Weiss, cockroach, topics."
Are you on the bill tonight? Did somebody come to hear you? Did somebody come to hear you?
Free, free Palestine! 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 Free, free Black lives matter. Black lives matter. Black lives matter.
I would respectfully submit that that we couldn't have paid for that to prove the point that we're trying to make about the importance of real dialogue as opposed to that, which is clearly a fascist impulse and authoritarian impulse that wants to shut down discussion and cannot engage in debate, which is ironic coming from people who usually accuse us of being the ones who want to stifle debate on campus, and then they do that. So back to the story real quick. The rabbi says, you know, I'm glad you don't bring that up. And I realized in that moment that he was asking for my silence, and he was asking for my collaboration with that silence. Okay, it's fine to talk about South African apartheid, but don't bring up our role, Tim, as Jews. And he would say things like, you know, because all the Arab states support South Africa too. That to me never made sense as an excuse, because I remembered as a time, as a child, and many of you may have this experience, playing baseball outside with a friend and breaking a window. And as I recall, when my mom got mad at me and I got in trouble, the excuse that Billy broke the window too was not accepted by my mother. As I recall, my mother said something about Billy and a bridge, and whether or not if I threw myself off of it in the manner of a damn fool, if he did that, would I follow him? You know, and so the rabbi was asking for my silence, and at that moment I realized I couldn't offer it. And that was the first time I ever wrote anything about Israel. I wrote something about, because what was ironic to me about it was four of the first prime ministers of South Africa, the heads of state in South Africa under apartheid rule post-1948, were imprisoned during World War II for collaborating with Nazis. So to me, it was very ironic to say we're not going to condemn Israel for supporting a government whose first leaders were Nazi collaborators. Not only is that offensive in terms of what it means for Palestine, it's offensive to me as a Jew.
Wow.
And I was told to speak up as a Jew against injustice, against others, and against my own, and that was what did it for me.
Yeah, no, just very, very briefly, I was blessed to meet my dear brother Edward Said 42 years ago. And he is the greatest public intellectual after the birth of W.B. Du Bois. Mm-hmm. And when you read Orientalism, you read The Question of Palestine, you read Saving Islam, you read his book on the Oslo Accords, it's as if they were written last week. Mm-hmm. It's that powerful. That his work constitutes a kind of BCAD in terms of the shift in the American discourse. Now, he didn't do it all by himself, but I was blessed to know him up until his death. We spent much time together. We had teach-ins at Columbia in the late 1970s and the early 80s, dealing with U.S. apartheid, Junior, which is new Jim Crow Junior, and South African apartheid, and vicious Israeli occupation, apartheid-like in a very, very ugly and vicious way. And he was already out there. And I remember the bodyguards, you know, right in front of his office each and every day, because he was under death threats, and then, of course, sooner or later, many of us joined that club. But let us never forget Edward Said. He's one of the great ones. He's one of the great
ones.
He's one of the great ones.
Well, you'd think that as a Palestinian, it's kind of comes natural. You kind of have to, one way or another, but I think that's actually not true at all, and you see a lot of Palestinians who have kept their mouths shut, who have changed their names, who don't identify as Palestinian, who have just gotten by, and they understood that if they speak out on this issue, it means their careers, it means a lot of things. So I think for me, it was really the family I was raised in, and you know, being in a family of intellectuals, being in a family of people who were speaking out all the time and, you know, were facing the death threats and had bodyguards, and, you know, it was real. And it was also always understood as a sense of responsibility. Mm-hmm. And having the privilege that I did, and being educated and being able to go to law school, those kinds of privileges are something that I never felt I could take for granted. So it was also for me the kind of educational path that I took, and the people that I was around. I always had a sense of this injustice being connected with all the others, and I I actually learned so much studying the history of Black resistance and Indigenous resistance, and that actually gave me a lot of courage as well, kind of seeing that, you know, it's not just us that has to resist. We all have to resist all of this injustice that we're facing.
Beautiful. Ahmad, where do you get your courage from?
Well, if I did not have the courage, I couldn't exist because I would have to live as a slave. Mm-hmm. And that's something I cannot tolerate. So to me, freedom means everything. And I couldn't imagine myself except as resisting in whatever means I can. But I certainly got a lot from my father, who was one of the founders of the PLO in 1964, and my mother and my grandmother. There were quite a few very strong women in my life, my mother, my grandmother, my aunts, who taught me a lot about resistance, about resilience, about refusing to bow to the occupation, to apartheid. And I think all of those factors have helped a lot. The second most important part that shaped my understanding of the world, actually, was by the very modest role I played in the South African anti-apartheid movement when I went to school at Columbia. I learned quite a lot from the Black leaders of that movement at Columbia. And it was like pulling nails at the time. It was not easy as people imagine it in a very romantic way. It took many, many years. And they led that struggle in a very white-dominated environment, a very elitist environment. But they pulled it through. And we did get Colombia to divest ultimately. So that taught me a lot.
Wow.
I mean, I will just share this, and it's something that I've learned from many leaders, but in particular from Dr. Cornel West, this idea of love. And he talks about love, 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 everything, love, love, love. And one time somebody asked me this question, you know, why do you do the work that you do? A lot of people say because of hope, you know, you hope and that you can see a vision. I don't always know if I see, and I realize it wasn't hope. And I think for me, my personal courage comes from deep love. Like, I love my Palestinian children. I love my Palestinian mother and my Palestinian grandmothers and my Palestinian great-grandmothers. And I think my courage comes from this love. And if one day I don't love those people anymore, which is never going to happen, that's when I will lose my courage. And so I want you to know, Dr. Cornel West, your particular inspiration of making us understand that we do this work from a place of love. And while everyone else is trying to label our work as divisive and comes from a place of hatred, it really does come from a place of love, in where we want everybody. I don't want something for me that I don't want somebody else to have. I don't want to take away from Jews just so the Palestinians can have. I want everybody to have liberty and freedom and justice and not only be able to survive but to thrive. So I appreciate you. I appreciate you very much. And I wanted to actually say something really positive about the young man, Tim, that left here, unfortunately. He's actually stayed pretty quiet throughout everyone's speeches. He allowed you all to speak, and then he decided to interrupt. So I will call him a quite respectful heckler. Thank you. We have to sometimes acknowledge the good, Tim.
He has high frustration tolerance, but...
Sorry.
Still nobody came to hear him, though.
Oh, no. Which is how I learned that whole chanting thing. So if you ever have organizing events and things like that happen, and not only about Palestine, but about anything around anti-immigrant, anti-LGBTQ, find a chant that you all love and agree with and everybody wants to say, and say it together and drown out hate. Because one thing that Dima did say tonight that I kind of a little bit disagree with is I do believe that we are sometimes out-organized and sometimes out-resourced, but I do not believe that we are ever outnumbered. We are not outnumbered, and we are more than them, and I believe that. So I want to give everybody one round to really answer this last question. We're going to bring up some fabulous people up here to help us close out the evening tonight. But I wanted to say, I mean, a lot of people here want to leave with something. Like, what do people leave here to do? What kind of advice do you give people in this very interesting political moment that we're in right now? And when people are telling you, be quiet, be silent, don't get involved in this issue, don't do this, don't do that, don't upset the status quo, what kind of advice do you give people when they leave here today?
So I'm just going to give the advice. Well, it's something that, again, goes back to the anti-apartheid movement that I learned that has been sustaining for me for 30-plus years since then. And it's helpful because if you're an activist on this or any issue, you face these moments of frustration and hopelessness and burnout and all of this, and you're constantly looking for that thing that gets you up the next day to fight the fight. And you know, justice and the cause isn't always enough to do that on every day, because sometimes we're weary, you know? And so when we were doing the anti-apartheid movement, like a lot of places, we didn't succeed in getting divestment. We thought we were on the brink. We, you know, Archbishop Tutu was offered an honorary degree. We got him to turn it down because we got him all the information about our investments. He said, oh my God, I had no idea. So it's this huge, you know, PR coup. We thought we were on our way to this big victory, and it didn't happen. And so we were all very frustrated, as we will all be if you fight for justice. And when we were at our most dejected, I was about to leave. This is sophomore year of college, about to leave to go home. I go to check my mailbox one last time, and there's a letter from Archbishop Tutu, who had written to me as one of the leaders of that movement, one of the founders of that organization. And it was this amazing letter. I had not had a chance to speak to the Archbishop, but it was as if he read my mind and our mind about sort of where we were with the frustration and the burnout. And of course, like an idiot, you know, I wasn't a hoarder like I should have been. And so I threw the letter away, but I memorized it. And I remember what the Archbishop told me. I will never forget it. He said, you don't do the things you are doing because others will join you in the doing of them, or because they will necessarily prove successful. You do the things you do because the things you're doing are right. And hearing that at the age of 19 or 20, whatever it was that I was, right, was the kind of thing that made me remember that justice may or may not come in our lifetimes with this or any other issue. We have a very short time on this planet. And what he was saying was sort of what Dr. West was saying. You have to make a decision what kind of human being you're going to be. And you have to make a decision to do, as James Baldwin said, earn your death. And that sounds like a very macabre sort of concept, earning your death. But what he was saying was you have to earn your death by confronting with vigor the conundrum of life, which is we are hurtling toward the grave from the minute that we are born, and we have a very limited time to justify the oxygen that we stole from others. And so in your time, figure out how you're going to do that.
That's great. I would say, care about something so much that all of the people in your circle, in your ecosystem, that if I ask them, what is it that you care about, they know. If the people around you have to guess and wonder what it is that you care about, I call BS on you caring about it. Like, you couldn't know me in any way and guess what I care about, because you see me fight against police brutality and mass incarceration. I know what every person on this stage cares about, not because they told me, but because I see them. And my wish, my hope for each of you is not that you pick my cause, that you pick police brutality or mass incarceration. If you do, great. My hope is that you pick something and believe in it so deeply, be it the climate crisis, be it human rights somewhere in the world, whatever the issue is that you choose, that everybody around you knows that that's your issue, because you're living a life that's so intentional, so on purpose, that it's just clear. And I say that as someone who took nearly 35 years to get to that point. It's a journey. And you can change your mind. You can pivot to new issues. And then lastly, I'll say that if you're struggling to pick just one issue, of course you are, because there's so much evil and so much despair around the world. How I try to flesh that out is, while I've picked my one issue, is I also try to support and amplify and encourage and high five and donate other people who've picked issues that are very different than mine. The truth is, you can only effectively fight but so many battles, but you can always support and amplify others
who have made a decision that's different than yours, but they're in the fight as well.
I think I kind of said my advice already, which is to defend people, to speak out for people who are under attack. I mean, I was telling Linda, you know, we're actually often therapists. You know, we're lawyers and people are calling us for legal help, but our number one job is to be therapists because it's traumatizing to be attacked personally in these ways. And we have so many people coming to us in crisis. And when they know we have their back, it makes a huge difference. But when they see other people calling them and checking on them and standing up for them and writing about it, and that's what keeps people going. That's what lets people know that they can continue to do this work and not be destroyed.
That's right.
So it's so important when you see these things happening to speak out and reach out and speak out again. So that it will also come back to you. I mean, if you hear Mark Lamont Hill talk about, you know, who called him when he was under fire, that's what people remember, and that's what that's the kind of solidarity and the kind of support that we all need to keep doing this work.
We love our dear brother Mark. I tell you, he's a courageous brother, very much so. No, for me, very briefly, though, it has to do with the how do you hold on to honesty in the face of deception, and courage in the face of repression, decency in the face of insult, and then with the voice of the integrity in the face of oppression. And you're going to fail. I mean, Beckett says, try again, fail better. That's the story of our lives. No messianic role for anybody. The question is leaving the world a little better. Our Jewish brothers and sisters talk about it in terms of tikkun olam, to amend the world. Now, I'm a revolutionary Christian, so I heard in Vacation Bible School as if the kingdom of God is within you, then everywhere you go, you ought to leave a little heaven behind. And that heaven has to do with the struggle for justice and finding joy in that struggle. So you're a blues person. All the catastrophe coming at you and you're soulful, which is the sharing of a soothing sweetness against the backdrop of the grim catastrophe, but with a smile and style with others throwing down and being willing to go down fighting and pass it on to the younger generation. And I'm the oldest brother here, Mo Gray, less wise, still swinging,
could be deceiving,
but joyful
Dr.
to see all these young folk throwing down, I'm telling you.
I'm about to turn 40, but I feel about 85. Let me tell you. I shared this quote at the last time when I was here at UMass Amherst, and I literally carried it around with me in my notebook, and I just wanted to share it with everyone here because it really speaks to the moment. It's by abolitionist Harriet Beecher Stowe. And she says, when you get into a tight place and everything goes against you till it seems as though you could not hang on a minute longer, never give up then, for that is just the place and time that the tide will turn. And the tide, sisters and brothers, is turning.
You have been listening to our final three-part presentation of the Conference on Criminalizing Dissent, held at UMass Amherst. We need more of these pro-Palestinian truth-telling conferences to be held on campuses across America to counter the Israeli propaganda that permeates both college administrations and the mainstream media. Such events are an important support to the growing Palestinian resistance, as is BDS. If you missed our earlier two broadcasts of the UMass conference, you can find them on our archive. In fact, you can access all our past broadcasts online by going to our permanent archive at truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word. Just type in truthandjusticeradio.org. Then click on This Week in Palestine Archive and choose your broadcast. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.